My name is Marilyn Simons, and I'm reading from my novel, Refuge, from the beginning. The first day. You can't lie to me. Oh, people have tried. All the usual prevarications, and some they make up just for me. Take a picture, and there's a chance you'll get away with it. But even then, more often than not, I'll feel that flutter in my gut, that shiver behind my eyelids when I spot a lie penciled on a face, and the words will come spilling out of my mouth before I have a chance to think them. That's not the truth. Not that it's ever done me much good. What's the point of knowing every time someone is trying to put one over on you? It's like having the gift of seeing flatulence. It shows you something you already suspect. Something you don't want to know too much about. That's what I'm thinking as I sit here on the veranda of my cabin, watching the girl row across the narrow moat of water that separates my small island from the farm where I was born. A gray moth with a smudge of rust on its nether parts moves slowly across the sagging screen in the opposite direction. I squint past it into the distance and wonder just what kind of lies this young woman will try on me. Because if I'm sure of one thing after 96 years, it's that I've pretty much heard them all. The only one who can lie to me is me. A moment of weakness made me spell out the directions to the island. Loneliness, the old woman's curse. While I may be old and weak, but I'm not entirely stupid. Not yet. Curious. I'll admit to that. The girl looks ordinary enough, not like a real estate agent or a social worker or a thug. That's one good thing, or three, depending how you count. And she's tidy. She's pulling the old rowboat up on the rocks, pretty much where I like it. Scrawny, though. Doesn't block much of the view. She's got her hair pulled up into a ponytail like I used to wear in the 50s. Looks like a boy in those blue jeans. No hips. But the shirt is so tight I can see her little breasts, round and high as suction cups. She takes nothing from the boat. No suitcase. So she doesn't mean to stay. Another good thing. Ah. That hump on her back is a day pack. Whatever she has for me is tucked inside. Smaller than an iron lung. Bigger than a tin of salve. A game we used to play. I shuffle my chair back into the shadows. The veranda is heaped with junk, oars, tripods, winter boots and coats, things I've been meaning to get rid of. Nowhere to sit, but that doesn't matter, as long as I can wheel myself through the breaks and the debris to my favorite lookouts. One at the far end of the veranda with a view of the lake, and this one by the screen door, where I can see the woods that shield the lake from the farmhouse, where I watch for strangers coming up the path. Halfway along, she stops, shifts the day pack to her other shoulder, and carries on. So, small but heavy as the weight of memory that holds me here. She'd pushed her head out of her mother's body at precisely 5:33 on the morning of the 28th of June, in the fifth year of the new century, the 20th century, which was new at the time, her papa's favorite story. As if unprepared at that moment to fully enter the world, she'd paused. Her eyelids, mouth, and brow worked in spasm, twisting the smooth features of her face into a scowl, a grimace, a wide expression of surprise. Then the muscles relaxed and the lids half closed in an air of resignation. Hello! Her eyelids fluttered. Her face was wedged to one side, so her father had to thrust his bushy head between his darling wife's legs in order to get a proper look. Crouched over the head of this half-in, half-out child, he locked his gaze on hers, forging a connection between them that spiked the hairs on his spine, his neck, his wrists. Then her eyes lost their focus, as if turning to deeper thoughts, and her lids drifted down. Hello, he shouted. Louder, and once more her eyelids flicked open, her look reluctant, expectant, curious, resolute, game. An expression her father could not fix with any certainty, no matter how closely he scrutinized the furrows of her forehead, the wrinkled skin around her lips. He glanced at the clock on the mantel. 20 seconds. 25. 30. long enough for every drop of blood in her tiny body to complete its circuit 60 times or more, for her lungs to fill and empty half as many times again, for the sound of his third "Hello!" to burst out the window and skim across the summer fallow fields and through the woods, fading to a whisper on the shore of the island, where it slipped into the water without a ripple. Her father made careful note of each stage of her birth, the head bursting forth like a blossom, the face turning aside to rotate the shoulders within the bowl of her mother's pelvis, that heart-stopping pause. Then, in a rush, torso, arms, toes, a great gasp and a cry, and she was borne out on a swell of membrane and blood. This was not the first human birth her papa had witnessed. He was already the father of eight daughters. But his concentration was sharpened by the knowledge that it might well be his last. The sun was casting off from the horizon, drifting up into a wide pool of blue. Her father picked her up in his broad, freckled hands and held her squirming to the window, a chant of birdsong seeping in through the open sash. He lifted her until her head was on a level with his, then higher, raised her to where the lake was a flash of silver through a hush of green. "Cass," her father said to the infant grown still in his hands. "Cass, look." "Papa, come look." She'd pull on the sleeve of his old plaid coat and he'd laugh, put down his tools and row with her to the island. The summer she turned 10, she built a hut there, using boards from a collapsed blind where her father used to crouch for hours, observing the nesting behavior of a pair of American widgeons. She nailed the cracked and splitting boards to a stand of cedars, stripping the bottom branches to use as thatch for a roof to keep out the worst of the weather. The weight of winter would break through her construction, and every spring she'd remake the hut, sweeping out the drifts of leaves and rotting nests, carpeting the earth with fresh boughs, adding boards to widen the walls and raise the roof as she grew. This is where she brought her lame and wounded. The blue jay with its broken wing, the nest of mouse pups abandoned by their mother, the barn cat that was half blind. She attached wire cages to the outside of the hut, carved splints and knotted slings. Every morning she rose herself across the strait with a muslin bag at her feet, bulging with table scraps, worms and crickets, various seeds. At the end of the day, she could scarcely pull herself away from the frail and broken creatures she'd rescued. She was convinced she could hear them calling to her in the night, their voices faint through the windows that May slammed shut against the dark. She barely knew her letters, but she understood the articulation of bones in their sockets, the cavities that cradle viscera, the placement of lungs and kidneys and heart, the organs of sight, digestion, reproduction, thought. She watched her father peel the skin from the head of a slaughtered steer and work the jawbone, noting the movement of the various muscles of its face, tracing each strand from its origin to its final attachment, probing with instruments he fashioned from bits of metal that fell off his machines, peering into the light that poured down from six oil lamps hung from a contraption he rigged from a rust-pitted harvesting rake. She was never squeamish, not in the least. She'd seen blood flow thin as water from a wound, seen it thicken to scarlet mercury, setting like choke cherry jelly as it cooled, darkening until it was black and sticky as tar, another substance altogether. Whatever shiver of discomfort she felt at the sight of blood was provoked only by the wrongness of it outside the body. Being the youngest of the McCallums was both her torment and her saving grace. Rarely noticed, she was seldom missed. She accumulated small comforts on the island, a blanket, a plate, a cup, a candle stub. She took to keeping an apple or two, a heel of bread, a rind of cheese tied in a cloth that hung from a branch inside her hut. No one seemed to care how long she stayed away. Except once, late in August, when the sky darkened without warning and a wind rose up, whipping Papa's voice to ragged snatches through the trees. "Stay where you are," he yelled when she came to the water's edge. He stood tall as a prophet in his flapping greatcoat, his fist raised in the air, silhouetted in a sudden flash of white against the towering, swaying spruce. They stood rooted to their opposite shores, peering at the water that heaved between them, the clouds surging above, swallows tumbling through the air. Then the storm bore down in earnest, and he waved her back into the trees. For hours she crouched in her hut, wrapped in a ragged quilt, thunder growling all around, erupting now and then in outrage, the gaps in the boards pulsing with wild light, then snapping back to blackness. Eventually, she slept, dreaming strange and restless dreams of faces she had never seen, places she had never been. She woke at last in the dark quiet to Papa bending over her, whispering her name, lifting her up off the boughs, damp beneath her cheek, the needles shifting against her skin like small snakes licking their tongues in the curled shell of her ear. All my life, that dream has haunted me. Maybe it was a prophecy that I would live as long as Methuselah and wait on this small island for a young supplicant to row across the water, struggle up the path, bearing her own brand of snake oil. A young woman who claims to be flesh of my flesh. Family at this late date, after I have outlived them all.